This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. When you open the menu in a fine restaurant, you think you're in charge of your dining experience, but Chris Failinger knows better. Failinger is a waiter who's worked in some of New York's trendiest restaurants. Being a waiter in that setting is a lot more than simply ferrying food from kitchen to table. The best waiters not only know all of the ingredients in every dish, but hold passionate opinions about cuisine. They also know how to sell food, like beef cheek ravioli and head cheese, using some crafty persuasion techniques that most of us would never suspect. Failinger no longer takes orders. Now he writes about food and wine for the magazine WineX. He's also the co-founder of Feast, a new online magazine about food, and is launching an online gossip sheet about New York restaurant culture at bitterwaitress.com. In restaurants, I always hesitate to ask the waiter to talk about the food, but Chris Failinger says he likes to.
It makes my life interesting, and once I got to my most recent job at Babbo, and when I really decided that I was a bitter waitress, it made it a lot easier. A lot of restaurants these days really kind of focus on using vague terminology in describing food, and their idea then is to engender a dialogue between the guest and the waiter so that the person is sort of forced into having good service because they don't understand the menu. And because the menu items are vague and you're talking to them, you also gain a great amount of control over their experience and can kind of lead them down whatever road you want to. And if you're in a great mood, you want to have fun, you can make it very interesting for them, serving them things like an all-organ meat tasting menu. Or one of the things I used to try to serve was the put the pig back together menu through all the different courses. Or you can just make it a very quick experience by just saying, no, no, no. Yeah, that's really good tonight.
Now, what's...
And people love it when you say no.
Why do they love it?
Well, because that means that you're not following some party line. You're not going to say, oh, everything's good. And when you say that something's not good, or if it's not good, I'd say it's not good. If it's not something I liked, I'd say it's not something I liked. And I would get in a lot of trouble for that. But people would trust you immensely because you're willing to say no. You know, you're looking out for them because they're spending a lot of money. I mean, for most of the places I've worked, you know, you're going to spend $25 on an entree. You want it to be good. I mean, for even people who can afford to dine out like that, that's still a lot of money to spend, and you don't want it to be spent on something you're not going to enjoy. And of course, then once they trust you, you sell them really expensive wine.
That's always the first thing?
Kind of, yeah. It doesn't have to be. It's not. You would never sell them expensive bad wine, but you do kind of play on their trust for your own benefit. It is a business transaction here. Let's remember that.
Is it really just a business transaction? Isn't it implied in your profession as a waiter that there's an element of service that extends beyond business?
I think that there is, but I think that diners and waiters will both enhance their experiences greatly if they realize that it is fundamentally a business transaction, which is to say, you know, it's sales too. You know, when somebody sells a car, they get a commission. When they sell, you know, expensive clothing, for the most part, they get a commission. And we get a commission. And what we really are doing is we're getting a commission on our knowledge of the food and the wine that we sell you and bring to the table, because that knowledge is fundamental to the enjoyment of your experience, and you're paying for that knowledge. Maybe it's not so much a standard business transaction then, and you can think of tipping more as a consulting fee. I think a lot of people would be happier if you did.
What other strategies do you use to get people to do your bidding, to order what you'd like them to get?
Well, I think you have to take into consideration the nature of each particular guest or the dynamic that's going on at the table. You know, if you've got the young couple out on a date and he's trying to impress her, generally you would kind of play things to him and he'd sort of be on the spot to make the decisions you want him to make and to tip you well and to spend more so that she's impressed. And sometimes you are around older couples that don't speak anymore, so that you just are very, very basic. You give them what they need. You don't try to engage them in conversation. You really have to become a little bit of a psychologist in being able to read people on whom you're waiting.
I know that one technique that you've used is to make everything on the menu sound so elaborate that people just can't figure out what it is and can't make a decision.
Yeah.
Can you give us an example of
that?
Say make something like, pork chops sound elaborate.
Well, it's not that they were pork chops. It's that they were really kind of bizarre ingredients. Pork chops in Italian, which is where I did this technique, was in an Italian restaurant, would be called something like costoletto di mai. And then you could say that these are special pork chops cut in the fashion of an Italian butcher. And then they're slightly aged, which you normally don't do with pork chops in America. And then they're seasoned with kosher salt, pepper, grilled. They're done on a bed of grilled Treviso. Treviso is one of the three kinds of radicchio. And then they're finished with, you know, some sort of bizarre thing that you have on the menu that you elaborate. Generally, I elaborated on what was on the menu. And made it seem even more elaborate. My favorite thing to elaborate on was head cheese. So working at a restaurant, we were serving head cheese, which is really just the most basic, desperate poverty food you can imagine. And I always would sell it by saying it's a very succulent, uncured pork sausage in which the sweetness of the meat is offset by the savoriness of toasted mustard seeds and pickled shallots. And by that point, people are just like, order for me. This is so complicated. It all sounds so good. That's the technique I would use when I was just not real, when I just wanted to like make it a quick experience, but still make them feel coddled.
In the kinds of restaurants that you've worked in New York, people have gone to extreme lengths to get reservations, to get in the door. The food is very expensive. They must have huge expectations that they're not willing to have disappointed.
Well, I think you're very right. The part about people's expectations are very, very unreasonable. Restaurants, sometimes through their own devices and sometimes through devices of the media, have just huge hype about them. And, of course, that's great for business. But people come with really, really shocking expectations. The fact is, it's just dinner. You know, nobody is going to be given new life and nobody is going to die because of what happens here tonight. And it's not rocket science, and you're not splitting an atom. You're just coming here to have dinner, and there's only so much you can reasonably expect. I remember a friend of mine was a waitress at Union Square Cafe, and she was telling me how one night this woman was crying because she didn't think that the waitress spent enough time with her. Now, granted, all the food got there on time. The food was exactly what they wanted. They loved it. But she just wanted more time. Well, you know, we're not nurses. We're not psychologists. We just serve food and wine.
Chris Failinger is my guest. He's a former waiter in New York City and the co-founder of Feast, the new online magazine about food and dining. We'll be back with more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Chris Failinger. He's waited tables all over New York City. He is the co-founder of an online magazine called Feast, P-H-E-A-S-T. It's all about food. Since you've worked in New York for a long time, you must have had a lot of experience with celebrity clients. Did people at other tables ask you what the celebrity was ordering when they saw them sit down at a table so that they could get it too?
Without a doubt. More so if the celebrity were somebody who had something to do with food, like Julia Child or Martha Stewart, than if it were just some celebrity. If it were some movie celebrity, the other guests would be particularly concerned about what kind of wine they were drinking, but maybe not so much about what they were eating. And of course, they were always very concerned about who they were with.
You actually had Julia Child come into a restaurant where you were waiting tables?
I did. It was one of the best waiting experiences I've ever had. She's just an amazing, charming woman and just fascinating to be around. And it's also great to just see how everybody sucks up to her and just I hope I'm saying this right, prostrates themselves before her because she's just such a goddess. And she's just humble and wonderful and loves food.
Did she order all sorts of kind of slimy French organ meat?
She ordered, well, it wasn't a French restaurant at the time. It was Union Square Cafe, which is an American restaurant with a little Italian influence. And she ordered raw oysters and really garlicky, delicious veal sausages, which was at lunchtime. And of course, every one of the ladies who lunched there, which is pretty much a high-powered publishing crowd, had to just have the same thing Julia did. And I'm like, okay, sure.
Do you, as a waiter, routinely eavesdrop on people's conversations?
It depends. For about the first 3 years I was waiting tables, I would. And then once again, when I decided to come up with my website, the gossip website I'm putting together right now called Bitter Waitress, I would listen pretty intently. And then there was a point for about a year when I just didn't even really care what they were saying, but I would love it when somebody said something that really, really caught my eye, or caught my ear, I should say. You know, when you'd hear a couple start to fight, or, you know, when a husband would admit to his wife that he'd been having an affair, or, you know, somebody would tell their parents they're gay at the dinner table. Just all those great things. You're just like, oh, okay, got to pay attention now. This is getting good. Then, of course, you'd run and tell everybody else and they'd walk by.
And is there a way that a waiter eavesdrops that doesn't betray what they're doing?
Waiters, you can always assume, are eavesdropping on you at every given moment. I could eavesdrop just by filling your water glass, and so here I am basically surveilling you, and you think you're getting good service.
What kind of people do you like to wait on?
Anybody who's just really into the experience, anybody who's just really genuine and is really into the idea of having good food and good wine and having a good time. I've had a lot of really great, great customers. One table that I'll always remember I waited on, they came in to Union Square Cafe, which isn't a very pretentious, but it's a very expensive restaurant. And if you don't know that it's really pretty laid back, you could get kind of put off by it. And this couple came in and they were somewhere, you know, from deep in Brooklyn, and they seemed a little bit, you know, nervous and kind of rough around the edges. And I really kind of sympathized with them because I've been in places that I shouldn't be in too, or didn't feel like I should be in. But they were very sweet. They got really into the whole experience. They couldn't decide on what they wanted. So whenever I goaded them into a decision for free, I would just send them out the other stuff that they'd been thinking about. And I turned the menu, which is a la carte, into a tasting menu for them, which is something that that restaurant didn't offer. And then for dessert, I sent them an extra course of desserts. And I sent them two dessert wines to match each course. And just because they were really nice, and then they told me that this was the first time that they'd been out of the house for any kind of real event in 10 months because they'd had a baby who was sick for 9 months of his life, and the mother had been in the hospital a month prior to that. And that was just so touching, you know, that they had put such expectations into that experience without actually coming to me and saying, oh, this is the first time we've been out, which is something so many people do. And it's just so tired and so old. You know, I don't care. I mean, make me care. And for these people, I really did care. I couldn't do anything else at that point. I had to pack up dessert for the babysitter at that point.
Oh, they just won the lottery with you.
Well, you know, you have the means to do that for people. And if people are even just half-heartedly genuine and nice and upbeat, you will.
I'm talking with Chris Failinger. He's waited tables for years in trendy New York restaurants. He writes a column for WineX magazine and is the co-founder of a magazine called Feast, all about food and gourmet eating. Did you grow up eating gourmet food?
I think the most gourmet thing that I grew up eating was something that actually didn't come frozen. So, no.
So when did you start?
When I started, I was 15, and I started as a busboy at this restaurant called the Villa Roma, which is this little restaurant in a little town on a little lake in Pennsylvania. And it was the kind of strange sort of Twin Peaks place where everybody was really backward and had a lot of money at the same time. So there was just this restaurant that served this amazing, amazing food that was completely new to me. And cooking was just the passion of one of the owners who was a self-taught chef, and she was excellent. And that's when I kind of started. I guess I was around 15 or 16.
Did you enjoy the waiting table so much, or was it this experience with the food?
Well, you know, I began in the kitchen. I was the busboy, then I was a kitchen manager, then I did a couple years cooking, and then I started waiting tables. And cooking in a restaurant is a career choice, and I didn't really want to do that anymore, but I did want to keep learning about food. So that's what I did with waiting tables. And the more I waited tables, I wanted to work in consistently better restaurants with more interesting food and more interesting wine, because it's a passion of mine. Food is just fascinating. And, you know, I've only in the past couple of years learned that there's a whole world of things that you can eat that you never thought you could or you never encountered.
In general, where are waiters in the restaurant hierarchy? Are they just pretty much down there considered eminently disposable?
It depends on the restaurant. In a 4-star restaurant, which is the apogee of dining in New York City, they're an essential part of the restaurant and they're indispensable. In a two-star or a one-star restaurant, they're considered dispensable, and they know it, so it's fine. It's in the three-star restaurants, which is a growing category. In these great economic times, great restaurants can abound. And waiters in that category get a lot of grief because everyone who opens a three-star restaurant wants it to be a four-star restaurant so they can become a legend, so they can become immortal, so they can make a lot of money. And you need a better staff to do that than you can get in a three-star restaurant. But at the same time, you also need a minimum, and that's not the kind of waiters who would work in, you know, the basic neighborhood restaurants. They're not going to cut it in the Gotham Bar and Grill and the Union Square Cafe. And it's actually gotten to the point right now where, you know, there's sort of a restaurant crisis in terms of finding good waiters. Yeah, waiters are disposable. I think, you know, right now, every waiter who hates their job should just spend 2 months learning Microsoft Excel and you can make more money temping.
You can't make a lot of money, though, in a restaurant, in these three-star restaurants that you're talking about.
You can't. No, I think that's a myth. What a lot of people don't realize is that waiters do get taxed now. And their taxes aren't based on what they actually make. When you work in a restaurant, you pay taxes based on a percentage. And the usual percentage in a good restaurant in New York is 17.8% of the restaurant's sales. So if you actually end up making 15%, you're paying tax on money that you didn't make. That's why we get so cranky about tips. You can make good money. I mean, I know when I was working, my best restaurant job in this city, I made about $220 a night, which seems good, and then you take the 35% off, and you know you're making about $21 an hour, which is what a bus driver makes in New York City. So you're not making that much. You're making a lot of cash, which enhances the perception that there's a lot of money, but it's not actual, you know, real generous income.
I'm talking with former waiter and food writer Chris Failinger. Who are good tippers? And does it break down by industry or profession?
Well, generally, anybody in the film industry tips really well, especially the movie executives. The best tipper in the world is Mike Nichols, and a great guy. People in television tend to tip very well. Stage people tip well, but they're bitter because they're not making as much as their counterparts on the screen. The people in the music industry are probably the worst. Madonna was a horrible tipper, and this is a consistent throughout a lot of restaurants. Natalie Merchant, who sings about poor people and injustice, is a terrible tipper, so I'm shocked by that. A lot. As far as other professions besides celebrity professions, generally, anybody in a big money profession like Wall Street tips well, but really more out of ostentation. Doctors and dentists are pretty bad tippers for the most part. The worst in terms of just non-celebrity professions are academics. I mean, they confuse tenure with privilege and privilege with somehow the fact that a waiter is a servant, and they're just nightmarish.
We've been talking a lot about New York restaurants, but obviously you have some experience in other parts of the world. Is a three-star or four-star or a fancy restaurant in New York a kind of a place unto itself? Or is there a certain standard that and a certain culture that is similar across the country?
I think that, you know, New York and San Francisco and New Orleans are really the three culinary capitals of the United States. And people in San Francisco hate this, but probably New Orleans more than San Francisco, because those are the places where there is either a lot of influence coming into the food or a passion for it. You know, in New Orleans, it's a pretty straightforward cuisine, but it's just impassioned and it's broad and it's all-encompassing. And in San Francisco, you get the wonderful influences of all the, you know, the different Asian cultures and Central American cultures and Latin cultures that come to San Francisco. And then in New York, you have both. You have that diversity and you have the passion for food. And you have the biggest, wealthiest market of diners. But I think other than those three cities, you know, you can go to Chicago and Los Angeles, and there are some excellent restaurants on par with any 3 or 4 star restaurant in New York, but there are fewer of them.
Chris Fehlinger, it's been interesting talking with you. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Chris Fehlinger is the co-founder of the new online magazine about food at feast.com. That's P-H-E-A-S-T.com. This is Fresh Air.